Welcome to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Gun violence is rampant in the United States, but the Supreme Court has restricted the legislature's ability to address this violence. We will explore these issues today. On May 24th, 2022, a gunman opened fire in Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. He killed 19 children and two teachers. 10 days earlier, a gunman killed 10 people in a supermarket in Buffalo, New York. This marked at least 246 mass shootings thus far in 2022 in the United States. There were 692 mass shootings in 2021 and 610 in 2020. These shootings continue to drive discourse and political action demanding stricter gun control laws in the United States. But the U.S. Supreme Court, in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, with these shootings in the foreground, ruled that state laws must reflect a Second Amendment protection that allows for individuals to carry guns for personal protection outside of their homes. On today's show, we explore the impact of the proliferation of weapons in the United States. And we examine the future of gun control legislation in light of the court's rejection of the state power to restrict gun ownership to private homes and gun clubs. Our panel today is Robert Spitzer, Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the State University of New York College at Cortland. He is the author of the books Guns Across America, Reconciling Gun Rules and Rights, The Politics of Gun Control, and his latest article on the NYSRPA versus Bruin decision, How the Supreme Court Rewrote History to Justify Its Flawed Gun Decision. Carl Bogus is professor of law at Roger Williams University School of Law. He is the editor of The Second Amendment in Law and History, Historians and Constitutional Scholars on the Right to Bear Arms, and the author of Gun Control in America's Cities, Public Policy and Politics. And David Hemingway, professor of health policy and director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. He is the author of Private Guns, Public Health, Reducing Firearm Violence, and How the U.S. Can Have Guns, but Fewer Gun Problems. Thank you all very much for joining us. And Robert Spitzer, let's start with you because you've explicitly addressed this opinion the Supreme Court has just filed about what the Second Amendment means. You suggested the Supreme Court rewrote history to justify this. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. In his majority opinion, Justice Clarence Thomas said that he believed in the primacy of reaching back to history as the methodology for interpreting, in this case, the Second Amendment right to bear arms. And his decision, like the District of Columbia versus Heller decision from 2008, which was the previous Supreme Court decision that established a personal right of citizens to have guns within their homes for their own protection, was a very history-driven decision. The problem with the current case decision, the Bruin case, is that the question that he addressed, that Justice Thomas addressed, was, is there a constitutional right to carry a gun outside of the home? And he concluded the answer was yes, based on his reading of history. The problem is the historical record is not ambiguous. It's exactly the opposite of what Justice Thomas said. That is to say, the default in our history, the legal default, was regulation and restriction of gun carry. If you examine the history of gun laws, and these laws are now available for inspection because they've been digitized and are available on the internet. And I've spent a lot of time looking at old gun laws. And gun laws, let me say, gun ownership is as old as America, but so are gun laws. The first gun law ever enacted on these shores was enacted in 1619, the year before Plymouth Rock, by what was what later became the Virginia House of Burgesses, their colonial assembly. the best way to summarize the default position about gun regulation with respect to carrying is to cite two basic facts of history. One is that from the 1600s to the start of the 20th century, every state in the country, except for three states, had enacted laws that barred or restricted gun carrying. The other relevant statistic is, and pertains to what's another sort of more public gun carrying, that is to say, gun brandishing and gun display. And at least two-thirds of the states had enacted laws criminalizing gun brandishing or display or both during roughly the same period of time, this several hundred year period. And whether you're carrying weapons concealed, the first category of regulation I mentioned, or publicly displaying them, it was well understood that carrying a firearm and certain other weapons around with you too was inherently dangerous and was inherently a threat. So to say that our history was somehow a history where people had a right to carry guns around with them, unfettered by government regulations, is just factually false.
And Carl Bogus, this is a court that has sort of pledged its fealty to this notion of, you know, original intent and the historic understanding, you know, of these laws. But this decision was actually pretty outside of the historical norms. It was pretty groundbreaking, wasn't it?
Yes, it was groundbreaking, and it follows broken ground not that long ago in at least the long sweep of history. So until 2008, the law, and if there's ever such a thing as settled constitutional law, the Second Amendment was settled constitutional law. Up until 2008, the Supreme Court had held in three decisions, the last one being 1939, that the Second Amendment only applies to guns in the government militia, the militia that's actually defined in the Constitution in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. It's under hybrid authority of the federal and state governments. And all of the lower federal courts had followed those decisions. To the extent that those decisions were ambiguous, and you could argue that they were a little bit, but all of the lower federal courts interpreted them as saying what I just said, that the Second Amendment is only applied to guns within the militia. And it makes sense, since the Second Amendment reads a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Then in 2008, for the first time, the Supreme Court held that the Second Amendment was principally about giving individuals the rights to keep guns for their own purposes, and specifically to have a handgun in their home for self-defense. Now, that was unprecedented. As Bob pointed out, that did not resolve the question about whether individuals could carry a gun on the public streets or have a gun outside the home. But there was an enormous amount of historical precedent for the proposition that American governments, state governments, federal government, could regulate that. And throughout long periods of our history, many states prohibited either concealed carry or open carry. There are two different types of carrying a weapon, carrying it concealed or carrying it openly. Concealed carry was considered a particular problem. And interestingly, when he was a member of the Virginia legislature, I think it was at Thomas Jefferson's request, James Madison twice introduced legislation to ban the carrying of weapons outside of one's own property unless they were on militia duty. So for many of us who have studied this for a very long time, this is just head spinning.
Now, we've been discussing some of the legal precedents and some of the historical precedents, but in some ways, I've kind of put the cart before the horse slightly. So David Hemingway, you've done quite a bit of research in the impact of weapons broadly as a public health question. We political scientists tend to view this as a rights question, power of the state question, as opposed, you know, to a public health question. But what exactly, you know, is the linkage that's been shown between gun possession, you know, gun ownership and public health risk?
So it's very clear. Places where there are lots of guns and weak gun laws, there's lots more violent death. The problem is that guns make hostile situations much more lethal. You just have to compare the United States with every other high-income country, and they have fewer guns and stronger laws, and we are a complete outlier in terms of our gun problems. I think an average in the United States per capita, we have about 20 times more gun deaths than the average other high-income country. If you look across states in the United States, states which have a lot of gun problems in terms of lots of not only gun homicide and gun suicide, but then overall homicide and overall suicide, because so many of the suicides and homicides are with guns. The states which have lots of guns and weak laws do much, much worse than the states like where I'm from, Massachusetts. We have strong laws and fewer guns. We still don't do as well as a lot of other countries which have stronger laws and don't have the military weapons and the handguns that we have. But we're almost always in Massachusetts, almost among the best states. And then if you look at households, households with guns, the gun is not does not make your household safer. The evidence is very strong that what the gun does is make it much more likely that someone in your home will die a violent death, a suicide, accidental gun deaths, and often domestic abuse killings. And so, and in public health, it's not just the deaths that matter. There's all these other costs from guns. Exposure to violence is just this enormous cost.
Yeah, Bob Spitzer, if I could just bring David's very important point to relate more directly to last week's Supreme Court decision, the Ruen decision. Aside from the obsession with history as the basis for determining constitutionality of modern gun laws, there are two big concerns that are raised and that were pervasive also in the oral argument last November that occurred in the Bruin case. One is the emphasis on safety, right? That people have a right to defend themselves to enhance their safety. And as overwhelming evidence that of course, David Hemingway has pioneered, and many, many others now have done the very important research, we know that introducing a gun into any realm, whether it's your home, the private realm, or the public realm, that it reduces safety and it makes harm more likely, not less likely. That is to say, it defeats the purpose of safety. And that relates to kind of a similar point, which is that if the preeminent concern is self-defense and safety, as the justices said repeatedly, there's never any discussion of other ways to make yourself safer. Even if you accept that a gun makes you safer, it is not the only way to improve safety, whether in the home or on the streets in public. And there's no consideration of the notion that there are other ways to protect yourself in addition to a firearm. And statistically, far better than a firearm. So to talk about safety in a real world way surely must lead one to ask, well, do these things make you safer? And guns do not make you safer. They make you less safe statistically for a variety of reasons that David and many other people have articulated.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the gun control discourses and the recent Supreme Court decision that will limit states' abilities to legislate gun control with Robert Spitzer of the State University of New York, Cortland, Carl Bogus of Roger Williams University School of Law, and David Hemingway of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. David, I know one of the huge challenges with these discourses from a public policy perspective is just getting data. There's been some restrictions, for instance, on the CDC's ability to gather data. And we're all, you know, or at least those of us who are social scientists, we need the data if we're going to be able to craft policy proposals. schools. How much of a challenge is it to get data on gun violence?
So it was always a challenge. The data are not very good still. We helped create the National Violent Death Reporting System, which it took 20 years. Now, finally, all 50 states are in it. So we're going to get at least national data for the first time. The data on non-fatal injuries is not very good. There are data which are collected, which are deliberately withheld from researchers, such as data on when you trace a gun, all the gun tracing data, we can't get the raw data. It's very difficult from the states to get data on carrying of guns. And then the big thing that happened is that in the mid-90s, the federal government basically stopped funding any research because of the gun lobby. In terms of what we know about all different kinds of injuries and diseases, probably disproportionately in terms of the seriousness of the problem, we've had much fewer studies. We've had like about 25 years with very, very few studies. It's only in the past few years that we've starting to get studies commensurate with the size of the problem. But still, even with the few studies, the evidence is so overwhelming. Just to give you something that we've done in the last few years is we looked at police killings. And it turns out in the United States, a police officer compared to a German police officer is so much more likely, like 30 times more likely to be killed on the job. Why? Because they get shot. They are 30 times more likely to kill civilians. And what we find is when you look across states, why do some states are a lot of police getting killed per capita and why in some states are a lot of civilians getting killed per capita? And you can think, oh, maybe it's there's more crime in some areas and so forth. And that's not the reason. The reason is very straightforward. The one variable that really explains the most by far is, are there lots of guns and weak gun laws? Because when there are lots of guns, then that's the only way basically to kill police is with guns. And when there's police are getting killed and there are lots of guns, when police go to an intimate partner violence situation, if they do it in Massachusetts, they're pretty sure that they're going to walk out alive. If they do it in a lot of states where lots of guns and weak laws, they have a much higher chance of dying. And so they're much more likely to shoot someone who they think is armed or someone who actually is armed.
Now, the follow-up, one area that I know there's been a lot of conversation, to you, David, that in the mid-1990s, under the Clinton administration, there was a pretty strong legislation, it's called Brady Bill, that banned these high-capacity assault rifles. And then that was allowed to lapse, I believe that was 10-year legislation, and then was allowed to lapse under George W. Bush. Have we seen a significant increase in violence? I mean, just to that specific piece of legislation, yeah. Enough that we can say that that is one of the causes?
Yeah, well, the Brady Bill, part of it lapsed, which was really the assault weapons ban, which was enacted basically at the same time. But and then the waiting period was relaxed. But so what we have seen is that mass shootings have increased in areas where there aren't assault weapons bans. And really, it looks like it's large capacity magazine bans that are most important in reducing the number of people killed in mass shootings and also the number of mass shootings. It's much harder to kill four people or whatever the cutoff is going to be if you just don't have a military weapon.
If I can just highlight what David said, because what he said was very important and deserves being repeated. And it is this, that we talk about assault weapons all the time, but the single most important element of a gun we call an assault weapon is the magazine capacity. How many bullets, how many rounds can that magazine hold? These days, 30 is common, 45, you can get even larger ones. So the rest of the aspects of what's an assault weapon is frequently cosmetic. Does it have a barrel shroud? Does it have a bayonet mount? It's how many bullets can you shoot before you have to reload? And it only takes a few seconds to reload. Take out the empty magazine and put in a full magazine. But nevertheless, every time you have to do that, it slows down a shooter. So that is a very important thing, to have a restriction on high-capacity magazines. The federal assault weapon ban that lasted 10 years was aspirationally excellent in that it ostensibly banned high-capacity magazines and I think limited magazines to 15 rounds, if my memory serves. But 10. Was 10, Bob? Thank you. But here's the problem. It was never really effective because it grandfathered in existing magazines. The magazines are very durable. And so when the legislation was going to be effective, you know, people bought up lots of magazines, which lasted those 10 years. I think they also didn't apply, by the way, to imported magazines. So some states are now banning high-capacity magazines. My state, Rhode Island, just did that about 2 weeks ago. But for your listeners, it's very important, if this happens in your state, to pay attention to whether it's grandfathering in existing magazines or not.
Yeah, on Carl's point, this is Bob Spitzer. Let me mention two quick anecdotes. In 2011, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords was at a meet and greet in Arizona when a guy walked up to her and shot her in the head with a handgun. And he emptied the magazine, the ammunition magazine, in his handgun and dropped out that magazine and went to put in a new magazine that was fully loaded, but dropped that on the floor. And a 60-something-year-old woman scooped that up. And other people standing in this vicinity jumped on the shooter. And as a consequence, stopped further mayhem. And there are other stories like that, where even the simple act of interchanging magazines can result in a jam, result in the passage of time that allows people to jump on the perpetrator or to flee. And moreover, it's pretty hard to come up with a coherent, sane justification for why civilians should be able to own large capacity magazines. What's the argument on behalf of a civilian being able to own a 30-round, 50-round, 60-round, 100-round magazine? I can think of one. It's because some shooters love to go to a shooting range and fire off hundreds of rounds in a few seconds. But after a mass shooting, you never hear a gun owner go in front of a camera or microphone and say, I don't think these weapons should be restricted because it's so damn much fun shooting them at a range. That's not, you know, a coherent public policy reason for not restricting them. Second story, in 2012 at a movie theater in Colorado, a man entered the theater at a midnight showing of a Batman movie with an assault weapon with a 100-round drum magazine and a handgun. Glock style handgun. And he killed 12 people and shot, I think, 70 in all. And had he had in his hand a bolt action rifle and an old fashioned and a revolver with a revolving drum, you need two hands to handle a bolt action rifle. He could not have fired off any comparable number of rounds, even though those are two guns, then you can kill people with guns. So the sheer quantity of firepower matters a great deal. And many studies have demonstrated that very thing, that more people die and are hurt when shooters have higher capacity ammunition magazines. And that by itself is a pretty compelling reason to impose limits on them.
And to follow up just quickly, what you're both saying here is that it's not really the assault rifle or the handgun. It's the amount of the bullets you're able to shoot, the so-called high capacity, because the Bruin case was about handguns, correct? But it was one of the high capacity handguns. And so it's possible that we could give both a right to bear arms, but restrictions on the magazine size, you know, and the capacity, and we could actually square that circle pretty easily. Is that fundamentally the argument that the two of you are making? Bob, I'll ask you first.
Yeah, the court didn't get to the particular question of large capacity magazines. The specific law that was subject to challenge is the New York State proper cause gun licensing law. And I'll add parenthetically that I have a New York State concealed carry pistol permit that I obtained some years ago. So I'm intimately acquainted with the process by which one needs to go through to get that. That process is being replaced as we speak by the state legislature and the governor, because the court decided that it was too restrictive. And the key question for the court was not so much that was not the variety of handgun, but the ability of a civilian to carry a handgun concealed with him or her around in society, and what you need to do to get the license to then carry the handgun. And the court did say that states can still have gun licensing, because most states do or did until recent years. It's a question of what you need to go through to get that licensing. And that's where the fallout from the Supreme Court's decision isn't yet entirely clear.
This is David Hemenway. And so I just want to talk a little bit about police discretion, because that's a big issue in this case, about whether or not police chiefs have the discretion not to give you a license, even if you can pass whatever requirements are there. And Massachusetts is still one of the states which has police discretion. We did a study of Massachusetts police chiefs. We have 351 towns. We have 351 police chiefs. We asked them, police chiefs, questions about, are you glad you have discretion? And the over 95% said, yes, absolutely. Why? And we asked them, how often do you deny someone? And these towns aren't very big. And the average was about one per year. And why don't you give them? And we said, give examples. And if you read the examples, no person in the United States would say these people should be allowed to carry guns. I mean, a common example was, we've been to their home six times in the past year for domestic violence and alcohol. And yes, the person has never been convicted of a felony, but we don't want them to have guns. Their neighbors don't want them to have guns and to carry guns. The second most common reason is, this guy's son came to me and said, Dad just keeps talking, he's going to kill himself. He's going to go off someplace and kill himself. And we just don't want him to have the gun. And then there are a number of incredible reasons. One was the police chief said, this guy came and said he wanted a license to carry. And I asked why. And he said, because I want to go to your deputy's home and shoot him in the head. And in most states in the United States, that person would be allowed to legally get a gun and carry it. And so it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in Massachusetts, because again, we probably are the state which every year is the sort of the safest or the second safest among the 50 states.
And with that, we'll take a break. When we return, we will discuss who exactly are the victims of gun violence, whether or not we spend too much time focused on mass shooting as opposed to intimate violence shootings in the home, and what kinds of policies would constitute sane, common sense gun control laws. And we'll be right back. Welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the recent Supreme Court decision, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin, the contemporary discourses about gun control and the historic context by which legislatures and courts have viewed the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Our panel today is Robert Spitzer, Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the State University of New York College of Cortland; Carl Bogus, Professor of Law at Roger Williams University School of Law; and David Hemenway, Professor of Health Policy and Director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. David Hemenway, you've done so much of the data collection here, and you'd made reference earlier in the show, kind of like to lay this out. In my intro, I talked about the number of mass shootings and the way in which we tend to frame this question is a question of mass shooting. You know, we certainly have had an epidemic of mass shootings in recent years, but still, that's not the most common way people are killed with firearms, is it?
Not at all. In terms of death, it turns out that suicide is always many more suicides than homicides. And there is about half of more of all suicide deaths are with firearms, even though only about 2 or 3 or 4% of suicide attempts are with firearms. Firearms are just so lethal. In terms of homicide, about 75% of homicides are with handguns. They are sort of one at a time, two at a time. And then there's unintentional firearm deaths, so over one a day. the people who are dying of suicides are largely gun owners and their families, older white guys, and sometimes and because they live in rural areas with guns. The people who are tend to be dying in homicides are young males, often minority males in cities. Disproportionately, the people who are dying unintentionally with firearms are too often young children under the age of 14. They're much higher risk of dying. That's just the deaths. Again, there's the non-fatals, the spinal cord injuries, the traumatic brain injuries. Then there's all the people who are affected. The evidence now is overwhelming about exposure to violence, particularly gun violence, can have long-run repercussions. These are not just the victims of the violence who are being have been shot. It's not just the people in the area who saw this, but in like mass shootings can have effects on a whole variety of people who are just watched it on television or something. It really increases the risk over your whole lifetime of both physical problems and mental health problems. And then in communities where there's lots of shootings, you can really destroy communities. You can destroy the fabric of the community. You can make it so firms don't want to come in. You can make it so people don't want to go outside. They're afraid to go outside. And it's sort of devastating for the social capital of the community. So the effects are really enormous in the United States.
Yeah, and Carl Bogus, you've written a book on gun control in America's cities. One of the interesting aspects of the discourse in the United States is kind of this rural-urban divide, the notion that, you know, gun owners are in rural areas, but critics of gun control typically point to the cities, and frequently Chicago is always referenced as the failure of gun control laws because there's still gun violence in the cities. I guess first is, how different is the discourse in urban areas versus rural areas, and how's that helped to frame the debate as to the effectiveness of gun control laws?
Well, gun violence is pretty widely spread, urban, suburban, and rural. I think more so than people realize, more so in urban areas, but it's nevertheless pretty widely spread. We do know that, as David has mentioned, less guns, less lethality. By the way, about the same levels of aggression and violence in the United States and across the globe. Americans aren't that different than people in Australia or Canada or the UK or Germany or other affluent nations. What differentiates us is when there is a burst of anger, a fight, a domestic dispute, or even a mugging in America, there's a gun at hand. And so the confrontation, the violence turns lethal. That's what differentiates us. And there's one other point I want to make that I think is really fundamental. And I suspect it has led the Supreme Court, in my opinion, to go astray in 2008 when it said the Second Amendment applies to individuals. And this time when it grants individuals the right to carry guns outside the home, and we don't know exactly where that ends. Can they carry it on subways and buses? And we just don't know. And it's this. You know, there's an old joke that says there are two kinds of people. There are people who divide the world into two kinds of people and those who don't. So that gets at something that's important here on gun control. Just about everybody on both sides of the debate, and I'm talking about the NRA and, you know, gun rights advocates, and I'm also talking about gun safety advocates, they both tend towards the same model, which is, if only we can keep guns out of the wrong hands and let law-abiding, responsible law-abiding citizens be armed, we'll have a sane and safe society. But here's the problem. There isn't that stark divide between the responsible and the irresponsible. Most people who kill somebody with a gun weren't previously convicted of a felony. Even 75% of mass murderers, mass shooters, weren't diagnosed with a mental illness, and only a tiny fraction that were diagnosed with a mental illness were diagnosed as psychotic. You bear in mind, by the way, that over the course of their lifetimes, most Americans will have a diagnosable mental illness at some point. So my point is that this idea that if we can just keep guns out of the wrong hands and let, quote, law-abiding citizens have guns, we'll be safe. We won't be safe. Can't divide the world up because lots of people have been law-abiding citizens in that they haven't been arrested previously, but may lose it in a domestic squabble, in a barroom brawl, or a road rage incident. And just one quick example, I forgot the year, but there was a road rage incident in Michigan. One driver thought the other driver was tailgating him. They got into kind of a dispute on the road. They both pulled off the road. They both took out guns. They both shot. They both killed the other person. And each of them had a license for that gun. The idea that good guys get licenses and bad guys don't, or that there's this good guy, bad guy model, is fundamentally flawed. And we're never going to make progress so long as that's the fundamental model.
Bob Spitzer, yeah, the world does not divide up into good guys and bad guys. That's not the actual world, just as Carl so eloquently said. And let me tack on with a related slogan. There's an old slogan that says, an armed society is a polite society. In other words, if people are carrying guns, everybody else will be more careful because they don't want to get shot. And exactly the opposite is true. So there have been numerous studies of this. For example, there was a study done of mass demonstrations in the last several years, and there have been a lot of thousands of mass demonstrations, especially related to the Black Lives Matter movement and other things too, demonstrations against mass mandates and so on, that produced data showing that when participants were armed with guns, the likelihood of injuries and deaths was between 5 and 6 times greater than when the demonstrators didn't have guns. That is to say, in a public setting, in a demonstration, more harm resulted when people carried guns. And the Kyle Rittenhouse case is really an exemplar. I mean, the 3 people he shot, 2 of whom he killed, those two people would be alive today. And the one person who was shot and survived would not have been shot had Rittenhouse not had a gun with him. And he still could have done the things that he claimed he went to the demonstration to do, which was to help people in case they were injured and to protect property. And so the mere presence of guns has an array of adverse consequences, partly because it emboldens people to do just as Carl described in the 2 road rage incidents, to actually pull out your gun and threaten and then use them. It's a classic instance of escalation, arms escalation, and international relations theory has things to say about that, which I wrote a little bit about over the years. And one other point regarding assault weapons, it's important to point out that the gun people have a point when they say there's too much emphasis and too much obsession over assault weapons. In this sense, as David pointed out, the vast majority of gun crimes are committed with handguns, and that includes gun murders. Assault weapons, when we look at assault weapons, they produce 3 kinds of harm. One is mass shootings. They're much, much more likely to be used in mass shootings. Their use in mass shootings has been increasing steadily since the assault weapons ban lapsed in the year 2004. They now appear in, I believe, over a third of all mass shootings. Handguns are still used more often in mass shootings. The other thing is, the other 2 consequences is that assault weapons are more likely to cause, to be related to shootings of police officers, and they are particular favorite weapons of gangs and gang-related activity. With final point with respect to mass shootings, terrible events. I mean, nobody disputes that a mass shooting is a terrible event, and it's no surprise that it receives so much attention. However, mass shootings account for roughly 1% of gun deaths in any given year, give or take. And it's important to remember that handguns continue to be by far the greatest criminological problem, the greatest problem when it comes to gun suicide. So regulate assault weapons. There are solid public policy reasons to argue on behalf of doing that, but they aren't quite the cause of mayhem, I think, that people might think, given the headlines that surround mass shootings.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We are discussing the gun control debates and gun violence in America with Robert Spitzer of the State University of New York College of Cortland, Carl Bogus of Roger Williams University, and David Hemingway of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. Carl Bogus, there's another element in this discourse that we haven't introduced yet. I want to make sure that we do. And that's the question of race and gun violence. And I think of two specific developments, you know, one relatively recent, the other historic. And that was the state of California's embrace of gun control when Black Panthers in the Oakland area began arming themselves. And so there's been this clearly a conversation about how much gun ownership is really about white gun ownership. And to drive that point home, one case that I've always thought that illustrated it, and I was shocked that the NRA did not come with any sort of rhetorical defense to Philando Castile, the African-American motorist who told the police officer that he had a registered gun in the glove compartment and was reaching for it, and then the police officer shot him. And I imagine if Philando Castile was white, the NRA would have had a very different response than the fact he's African-American. How much does race infuse itself in the historical discourses about gun control?
A lot. And it always has. So why did Madison and the first Congress write and propose the Second Amendment to start with? I've been arguing for a long time that the principal motive was to ensure that Congress, under the new Constitution in the new United States, Congress, which had just been given the lion's share of authority over the militia that had previously been exclusively state organizations, that Congress could not use its new power to disarm the state militia. And why would they do that? Well, in a debate in Richmond, Patrick Henry accused Madison basically of writing a constitution that allowed the North, which would soon control Congress because it was growing more rapidly than the South, to subvert the slave system by disarming the state militia. Now we think of the militia, if I say close your eyes and is there an image that comes into your mind when I say the militia, you might think the Minuteman holding the musket at Lexington or Concord. But in fact, after the Revolutionary War, where the militia had demonstrated that it was not a capable military force, the militia had only one use, and that was slave control. And that was absolutely essential in the slave states. It was an existential threat that if the militia was somehow weakened and disarmed, that you'd have slave insurrections. So that is why I think the Second Amendment was written. Yes, there has always been a greater tendency to, in many areas, enforce restrictions on blacks more than whites. When the Black Panthers brandished rifles, and when black students at Cornell brandished rifles and said that they were exercising Second Amendment rights, it terrified whites. But here's the thing. It's people of color who are disproportionately affected by gun violence, and it is particularly African Americans who are most in favor of gun control regulation.
Absolutely. And the impact of the cities. And I also would suspect that opponents of gun control pointing to Chicago, there's clearly a racial element, you know, in the city, saying it's not necessarily, you know, working in the cities, immediately comes to mind there. Now, David Hemingway, you have written how the U.S. can have guns, but fewer gun problems. How can the U.S. have guns, but fewer gun problems?
Well, there are just so many different ways we can, and there's so many different policies and programs that have nothing to do with writing laws about what people think of as gun control. For example, I'll just talk one small area, which is suicide, but I could talk about homicide, I could talk about unintentional gun deaths and on, but in the suicide area, one of the things we really know for sure is that a gun in the home is a risk factor for everybody in the home for suicide. All the suicide experts understand this, but the average citizen thinks, no, that's not true. If you really want to kill yourself, you will. And so one of the nice things would be if the Surgeon General did a report, which is the Surgeon General did a report about cigarettes, which made a big difference. The Surgeon General could do a report about suicide. The evidence is now, I would say, stronger about the relationship between a gun in the home and completed suicide as it was when the Surgeon General initially talked about the relationship between cigarettes and cancer. Another example is public health is doing lots and lots of things that have nothing to do with the laws directly. So one of the things we've been doing is we've been working with gunners. They are not the heads of the guns lobbies, but people who love guns. And one of the things that we've been working with them on is about suicide. It turns out that probably most suicides are pretty spontaneous. It's very few suicides are there's really careful planning. You wake up in the morning and things are so black, nothing can do it and you're going to commit suicide and you use whatever is handy. We're working with the gunners about what they are calling the 11th commandment of gun safety, which is just as friends don't let friends drive drunk. So it should be when your friend is going through a bad patch, he's drinking, he's getting divorced, then he's drinking and he's just talking crazy. It should be your responsibility, and he should know it, that you will, and these are their words, quote, babysit, end quote, his gun for a while until he gets a new girlfriend and things get better. And you can really reduce suicide. And they understand, you know, and they're starting to sort of understand this. And we're working with gun trainers that they should not only sort of train how to shoot straight, but they should be training on about understanding about suicide for the first time, which they haven't done at all. And in Utah, where we first started doing this, for every unintentional gun death, which they were training about, there were 80 gun suicides. And they just, like, that sort of blew their minds. And so gun training should not only be about reducing suicide, but it also should be figuring out how to lower tensions. If you have a gun, instead of just figuring out how to shoot people, you should try to make sure you are trained as a, quote, supposed good guy. And again, the evidence is that most people who commit homicides could have passed the background check the day they did their shooting, whether they got the gun legally or not. But there are just so many things the government can do. The government should be doing lots more research about smart guns. They should be writing standards about guns. They should be funding more research. They should be creating better data sets. There's so many things that groups should be doing in the United States. Hospitals are slowly starting to do really good things, so that it used to be when someone came in shot, they would fix them up and send them off. They get shot again. And now finally they're trying to figure out this is a teaching moment that these people need help and that we have to help them so that they don't go off and either get shot again or be the shooter. The police are starting to learn that they can do more things about prevention. Faith community is starting just a little bit, but the faith community could do a whole lot. In my injury prevention class, one of the exercises we do for a whole period is just list all the all the organizations, all the groups, from hospitals to actuaries to insurers to Hollywood to you name it, and all the things they could do if reducing gun violence in the United States was something they wanted. And then we talk about all the different things the government could do. And then we talk about all the different myths and all the different social norms that people believe in that aren't true, that sort of need to be changed. One of my hobby horses is I want to change the social norm about selling to a stranger without a background check. It should be illegal, but whether it's illegal or not, it should be considered immoral, should be considered a lethal sin that you would sell a dangerous, lethal weapon to someone who you have no idea who they are. But there's the public health approach is really not just about one or two or five, but about large numbers of things that can be done to really reduce the problems of guns, even without laws. Now, laws are really important often, but you can do so many other things which we typically don't think about. And that's what public health is a lot about.
And Bob Spitzer, this will be our last question then. Be remiss if we don't acknowledge that Congress has passed some legislation to address gun control following the shootings in Buffalo and Uvalde. It's my own thoughts, and I suspect you may share this, is that it doesn't go far enough and there needs to be more. Ideally, what would be the emphasis of the next round of gun legislation regulation?
Well, let me begin by mentioning something that we've alluded to, which is that there is a public policy focus to get at the kind of mental health problems or depression or anger issues that often lead to gun violence, suicide, homicide. And in the legislation President Biden signed this past week, there is a provision to provide funding to the states to encourage them or to expand what are called red flag laws. 20 states have them already enacted. Now, that's a public policy change, but one of the things that's distinctive about it is the fact that red flag laws have bipartisan support. They've been enacted by conservative states like Indiana and Florida and other Vermont, which liberal state, but a very strongly gun rights state. And that gets at the ability of people to find a way to remove guns from an individual who may be suicidal or homicidal. And that would be a public policy avenue that could be pursued more strongly after the law that Congress enacted. In addition, another provision of the laws, the bill signed into law, is that it calls for a more detailed background check of people trying to get guns who are below the age of 21, looking at juvenile records, mental health records. That's going to be an implementation problem, partly because that kind of data is not necessarily well gathered by the states and reported, and there's probably going to be a long timeline to get that done. But it does go back to the larger question of doing a more detailed background check and having more and better information about people who want to buy guns. And I would also just say at a final point to David Hemenway's point, which is that public policy routes aren't the only one. Where are the public service campaigns? Where are the 30-second spots during the Super Bowl that emphasize the importance of gun safety and safe gun practices? What about, you know, urging people to get and use gun locks? Roughly half of guns in homes are not locked up at all. Even the NRA tells you you should put a lock on your gun to keep it at home. And community violence intervention programs have proven to be quite successful. They were thwarted to some degree because of the pandemic. You couldn't be going door to door in the height of the pandemic, right? But there's more funding for those programs. You don't need to change public policy. You want to provide funding to support those programs. Those are effective, especially in areas that tend to have higher gun crime rates. So, you know, much more can be done that doesn't have to hinge on public policy. I will say there certainly will be a desire to continue the effort to improve the federal gun law situation, which isn't particularly efficacious, but I think that is something that we will not be seeing in the immediate future.
The last comment is that the greatest challenge to greater laws and public policies is the Supreme Court that's signaling that some of those might actually be overturned. So the importance of these types of campaigns are absolutely essential going forward. And the one thing that critics of gun control laws do partially have rights is that this is also a cultural question. I always find that, you know, should it be about healthcare, mental health? Should it be about culture? Should it be about, you know, gun laws? Why not all of them? Since this is clearly an epidemic of crisis proportions. We've been discussing the gun control discourses, gun violence, and what we as a society can do both legally, socially, culturally, et cetera, and how historic or ahistoric the Supreme Court's decision in New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin actually was. Our panel today has been Robert Spitzer, Distinguished Service Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the State University of New York College at Cortland. He is the author of the books Guns Across America, Reconciling Gun Rules and Rights, The Politics of Gun Control, and his latest article on the NYSRPA versus Bruin decision is How the Supreme Court Rewrote History to Justify Its Flawed Gun Decision. Carl Bogus is professor of law at Roger Williams University's School of Law. He is the editor of the Second Amendment in Law and History, Historians and Constitutional Scholars on the Right to Bear Arms, and the author of Gun Control in America's Cities, Public Policy and Politics. And David Hemingway, professor of health policy and director of the Harvard Injury Control Research Center. He is the author of Private Guns, Public Health, Reducing Firearm Violence, and How the U.S. Can Have Guns, but Fewer Gun Problems. Thank you all for joining us. I'd like to give a special thanks to the Scholar Circle team, Maria Armudian, host and anchor, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongri, webmaster and production assistant. All Scholar Circle shows are archived on scholarcircle.org. You can find our podcast on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle Twitter account, and please join our Facebook page. On behalf of the Scholar Circle team, I am Doug Becker. Thank you for listening.